Mr. Packard, might as well stay up there. Agenda item 9, enforcement report.
Okay, thank you. The first part of the enforcement report is what you normally see in your agenda, and includes the listing and the spreadsheet of violations, and I'll be happy to answer any questions about those if you have any.
Yep, just a quick one.
Go ahead.
The city of El Paso de Robles, what we normally call Paso Robles around here, mm-hmm. What was that regarding?
Can you give me a page number?
It's summary of enforcement activities. It's right.
Oh,
first
right
thing
on the
listed.
Top page.
Yeah.
Right. They, while they're working on a new treatment plant, their old treatment plant continues to have violations of their discharge permit, which triggers mandatory penalties. And we try to resolve those outside of a hearing. You know, they agree there's nothing they can do to contest them, and so we'll typically send them a letter once every year, maybe 2 years, with a summary of the violations. If they agree that those are the same ones that they've observed, they'll just send in the check basically to the state, and we'll clear those off the record.
So what's the schedule for completing the new system?
That's a good question. I believe they haven't started yet, but they did manage to get a rate increase passed, so that was a big, big step. They're in the process of the final design now, and I believe it'll take about 3 years for construction.
Okay. Well, so making some progress.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And Mr. Packard, you know, maybe for our newer board members, this enforcement policy applies to our state permits, not the federal permits?
Well, it applies to both. And if you'll give me a few minutes, I actually have a little presentation that talks more about the enforcement policy.
Okay.
Part of the staff report. Let me get that up.
So what Harvey intended to do was answer the questions about the normal listing that we have as far as enforcement actions. And then, actually, I think, Mr. Chairman, it was your request some time ago that mm-hmm. we have a summary for the board, a little presentation on the relatively new enforcement policy, so that the board can have a little primer before we actually have something like an administrative civil liability before us. So
okay.
That's what Harvey's going to do now.
I remember that.
Okay.
Okay, so what I thought I'd do today is just provide a summary of some of the key points in the water quality enforcement policy, especially a discussion about the penalty calculation methodology. I won't go into a lot of detail, and when the board does hear administrative civil liability case, we will go into much more detail about all the specific steps. But this gives you some information to get started. If you want to look at the policy itself and read all the details, it's there and available for you. This written report includes three charts that summarize the calculation methodology, and it includes an excerpt from the policy which talks about the penalty methodology. Let me start with a quick quote right out of the policy. It is the policy of the State Water Board that the Water Board shall strive to be fair, firm, and consistent in taking enforcement actions throughout the state while recognizing the unique facts of each case. And we try to do that by first issuing orders that are legally enforceable. So we have something to base our enforcement actions on. We need to have a consistent and valid approach to determining compliance with those orders. We need to issue enforcement actions that are suitable for the types of violations that we have, provide consistent treatment for violations that are similar in nature and have similar water quality impacts, make sure that we're treating fairly people of all races, cultures, and income levels, and that the board recognizes the unique disadvantages that some small and disadvantaged communities have. we can't get to every violation. We have too many violations to take formal enforcement on, to take if we're going to do them all. We can't do it. So the policy includes a framework for prioritizing those violations, and it sets them up into three classes. Our target is to include formal enforcement actions for violations that are in the top class. That doesn't mean that the others may not have other types of enforcement actions, but they probably won't be formal, which would mean a verbal follow-up, a notice of violation. Those are both informal types of enforcement actions. The criteria that we use to prioritize the violations take into account both the violation itself, the severity and the nature of the violation, and the characteristics of the discharger. So if a particular discharger has a lot of small violations, that's still going to raise a flag for them. The policy includes what I've mentioned already, is a penalty calculation methodology. And what that does is that it's a fairly formal way of calculating the penalty that should be applied to the violation. The policy includes 10 steps that lay out the methodology, and the idea is that we get fair and consistent liability amounts across the state for similar types of violations. Another goal is to fully eliminate any economic or competitive advantage that a discharger may have accrued by committing violations. We want to make sure that the relationship between the violation and the enforcement takes into account the gravity of the violation, the harm to the environment, and the harm to the integrity of the regulatory program. It's also very important to deter future violations, both for that specific discharger and for the discharger community in general. A way that we try to make sure that there is deterrence is by issuing news releases with major penalty actions, make sure that the community is aware of what we're doing. It's also important that the penalty amounts are sufficient to have that deterrent effect. The methodology uses provisions and factors in the water code to calculate the penalty, and we use a spreadsheet actually to make sure we're taking into account each step and to do the math for us. That methodology then becomes the basis for a staff recommendation, which the enforcement team would bring to the board. The board can modify that recommendation, but the board needs to bear in mind that orders have to be based on findings in the order, and findings have to be based on facts and evidence in the record. And my last slide on the methodology is a quick summary of the methodology itself. The charts in your staff report are a little more detailed. I'll go over this one quickly. We start with the days and the gallons of violation, and that we get that through our investigation of the circumstances. The water code includes...
Harvey, may I... I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
I just want to clarify, because I think this is from my own understanding. You stated that the calculations are based both on water code provisions, and you have a worksheet that allows you to take account of factors, so you're doing this on a consistent basis in terms of what elements of the discharge violation you might consider as a penalty. And then you said report findings in the record. And findings in the record includes both reports that are required, such as monitoring reports and annual reports, or does that include site inspections? And what kind of a record does staff create of observed violations or failure to implement BMPs, et cetera?
Right. It would include those things you mentioned. We're talking about a spill. It would include staff's investigation into the spill and the discharger's reports on the spill. The record would include staff's discussion on the factors from the Water Code. So our basis, staff's recommendation and basis for the proposed penalty, we're talking about a reporting violation or a effluent limitation violation. It would include the monitoring report that the discharger submitted that included the violation. So it would include anything that the enforcement staff thinks justifies the enforcement, and the record also includes the discharger's information about its opinions and facts on the subject. The Water Code includes statutory penalties for these violations. For instance, Section 13385 of the Water Code, which is based on enforcement of the federal NPDES program, so it's state, the Water Code includes the state and the federal programs, includes a maximum penalty of $10,000 per day of violation, and in addition, $10 per gallon of waste that's discharged in violation. So on top of that, I have in that box there per gallon per day factors, and those factors include the potential for harm caused by the discharge, the risk and harm from the discharge, and its susceptibility to cleanup. The conduct factors apply to the conduct of the discharger. So those include the culpability. Was the discharger negligent or was it an accident? Those are factors that we have to consider. The past history of violations of the discharger and the level of cooperation and cleanup that the discharger exhibited. All those factors go into what we call the base liability.
And question? Harvey, for conduct factors, are there multipliers?
Yes.
Spelled out in the code? Like
they're spelled out in the enforcement policy.
Okay.
Right. The code says, the Water Code says you have to consider these things. And what the policy does is it actually puts that into a multiplier.
So give us an example, like for something that was intentional versus an accident. What are the differences in the multipliers?
Right. I believe that multiplier you can use between 0.5 and 1.5. So you could, you know, expand the penalty amount. Either you could cut it in half or you could increase it by half.
For intentional.
For culpability. So if it's a complete accident and the discharger had done everything possible to foresee the problem and to make sure it didn't happen, then you could have a factor of 0.5. If he was negligent, should have known, should have stopped it, and could have stopped it, maybe we'd use a 1.5.
Does so the range applies to all of the different types of conduct. You could, the board could decide on a 0.5 multiplier for, in one case, because of intentional conduct, but 1.5 in another case based on just negligence.
Exactly. And then after we figure the base liability, there's some additional factors that we need to consider. That includes the ability of the discharger to pay the penalty and still continue in business. One that the Water Code, other factors as justice may require. That's typically where we will factor in staff costs in investigating and bringing the enforcement action. We'll recover those costs. The economic benefit, we have to consider the benefit that the discharger may have accrued, and that the penalty needs to be at least, in fact, the policy says at least 10% greater than that benefit. For NPDES violations, the statute clearly says that the penalty cannot be less than the economic benefit. And then we compare it to the maximum and minimum liabilities to make sure we're in the correct range. And that gives us the final liability. Any other questions about that? I know it's pretty quick, and it'll make a lot more sense when we actually come back with a case. Right.
Dr. Wolf.
Yes, and I don't mean to be out of order, but you know we moved a little bit at the next step on item 9 before I had a quick clarification. So I'll start with page 3 of item 9, last paragraph. We make reference to the limited resource of staff to address SEP program.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to mention that, you know, SEP has been extremely beneficial to mitigate environmental damage done on a local base. And I would be very concerned to see, no pun intended, the dilution of the SEP program, because the whole concept is to make repairs to the damage that has been caused locally. And so if we start reducing the SEP program mitigation on a local base, I think we're really not serving the environment and the local community that has been affected. So that's a kind of a general statement and sort of a little red flag that I'd like to bring up.
Right.
The next item is on the enforcement report, page 4 of 39, and specifically addressing the Cambria raw sewer spill. And we're looking here at a class 1, which is the highest category. You know, if my memory serves me right, 14,000 gallons. And if we look at the root cause was a circuit breaker which failed. And to compound the problem, the failure of a standby generator. And this is not the first time we have had, you know, very significant spills due to what appears to be inappropriate preventive maintenance of mechanical and electrical systems. So I'd like to remind particularly our staff and Mr. Roger Briggs, we had discussions on this, but I think it's very important to start addressing the needs for you know, industry standard practices on preventative maintenance, because this particular incident, I would submit to you, was probably avoidable, particularly since we see that the standby generator was not even operating. So
I'm not going to say anything other than, in general, I agree with what you're saying. This has the potential of coming back to the board in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then my next item is on page 12 of the factor 1 harm or potential harm to beneficial uses. And in the item 5, which is a major major category, we refer to high threat to beneficial use, i.e. significant impact to aquatic life or human health. I would like to see this language changed to significant impact to plants, animals, and aquatic life, because it clearly encompasses all those three categories. In fact, later on you make reference to those three aspects.
I'm sorry, what page was that?
This was on page 12, factor 1, harm or potential harm to beneficial uses, and we have 0 to 5 category, and under the major category, we had limited the impact to aquatic life or human health.
It's attachment 4, Dr. Hunter, at the end. Keep on going.
I will point out this is a statewide policy adopted by the State Water Board. We're not going to change any wording here, but...
Well, I suggest they change it.
Next time it comes up for a revision, we can definitely talk about that.
Then on page 14, under high volume discharge, we refer to a maximum amount of $2 a gallon. And I thought I heard you earlier that the permissible amount is $10. So my question is, why are we starting with a 20% threshold of the maximum while we already have compounding multipliers to either reduce the $2 or increase the $2? So what was the rationale to pick 20% of, you know, the the maximum allowable value?
The rationale there was that in statewide experience, there'd been cases where if the board had used the maximum of $10, the penalty came out to be way beyond what was reasonable. And so the policy, recognizing that, built in that factor there, it says should be used. If the board decided they wanted to use 3 or 5 or 10, they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But enforcement staff will probably come to the board with using that recommendation of 2.
Okay. Because the other point I was going to make, and not to turn this into a, you know, an accounting program, but you know, $2 today means one thing. $2 5 years from now means something else. And there is no recognition for inflationary aspects or even CPI.
Yeah.
And I notice we go into a lot of detail down to the, you know, 5% adjustments. So in some areas we are very, very detailed in trying to fine-tune what the fine is, but then we do have that rattle loose element.
Right. And I'll point out that the statutory amounts in the water code haven't changed or been adjusted for inflation for many years also.
Okay.
But if you're talking about a spill of millions of gallons, then your maximum penalty amount is pretty high to start.
Yeah. So still on the same topic, page 19, we refer to step 6, ability to pay and ability to continue in business. And I thought this was a little vague, because how do we calculate economic sustainability? You know, somebody comes and say, you know, I can't afford this, I'm going to be out of business. Now, in one hand, we go through all these calculations and these steps, but then it becomes, you know, one opinion versus another. So what is it based on? Is it based on the debt equity ratio of that business, on their balance sheet?
Mm-hmm.
I thought this whole portion here could very easily negate all the other efforts that were made to, you know, assess fairly and accurately the damage.
I agree. It is general, and the water code just says the board has to consider the discharger's ability to pay. And staff usually doesn't have a lot of information about that ability to pay.
Mm-hmm.
We'll make an estimate based on the information that we do have. If the discharger were to submit detailed information, we would consider that and present that to the board for consideration. And in some cases, we may ask state board assistance with analyzing that. They have economists up there that can help us do that. So we can get into the details if the discharger really wants to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the clarifications.
Okay. There is a floor, at least, with that the economic benefit amount, we can't go below that. So that's the safety net. So, well, hopefully you'll see an ACL hearing so that all this can be played out, and it's interesting.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned as one of your strategies for discharger communities to keep that awareness up is that you publicize the enforcement actions.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I read somewhere in there that the use of the dollars is actually a process that has to be approved through maybe the state board, how you're actually going to use those enforcement dollars. But is there actually a component of this that's a proactive approach, or one that actually recognizes when people are doing things right? Say, for example, the 14,000-gallon sewage spill, mm-hmm. based on poor maintenance on a circuit breaker, poor maintenance on a backup generator. Is there a method in this process where you actually can do proactive outreach, where you're tracking certain types of things that keep recurring, and you can actually use those financial assets to proactively inform the community to look out for this type of thing? Or even that if you have a significant type of discharger potential customer that's never had an enforcement action, are we publicizing that accomplishment, so
mm-hmm.
to speak?
The water boards don't have any awards that I know of to recognize great dischargers. Other groups do, engineering societies, the operator societies, and in fact, a lot of times when they're considering those awards, they'll send notifications to us to make sure that they're made aware of any violations or enforcement actions. With regards to spills, these agencies are required to have a management plan in place that details what they are, what actions they are taking ahead of time for maintenance, for preventative actions to make sure they don't have spills. So they've got, and that, it documents how much they're spending, where they're spending it, what they're doing. So that stuff all should be spelled out ahead of time.
But this particular component then is much more reactive than proactive.
Right. Okay. Enforcement, by its nature, is reactive.
We could argue that at home with the kids, but okay, thanks.
I mean, it starts out with the enforceable order and making sure they're aware of what the limits are, how they're going to meet them, and making sure they know what the penalties are.
Dr. Hunter.
Thank you, Chair Young. I wanted to just add my comment to Dr. Wolf's view on SEPs and the value of SEPs. I agree that I've seen some really excellent projects that have come out of those funds and helped to do important creek restoration and so forth. But the question I have for you, as staff cutbacks occur statewide and these funds are available, but of course the question of managing, and I have also seen some projects that have been enormously time-consuming for staff to really track and make sure progress and time schedules and so forth are being met. But Mike, I'm curious, is it possible for staff to also allocate funds as part of the SEP overall package of funds to support staff time in order to manage the project so that we don't diminish the number of SEP projects that come to our region as opposed to, because those funds are competitive to some degree. They're available to all regions in the state out of the same pool, right?
Yeah. I actually have two more slides that are going to talk about SEP, so we'll get into some of that. First, I want to point out and make sure that everyone understands where the penalty goes. There are two funds in Sacramento that receive these penalties that the board adopts. One is called the Cleanup and Abatement Account. Its primary use is for emergency cleanups where there's an ongoing spill or problem that we can't find the responsible party for. We can take money out and do emergency actions for that. And it's also available after emergency actions for non-emergency mitigation or cleanup. And any governmental agency can apply to the cleanup and abatement account to use those funds. The other fund is called the Waste Discharge Permit Fund, and that's the same fund that the dischargers pay their fees into, their annual fees. And the statute specifies for each type of violation where the penalty has to go. And getting to SEPs, those are both great comments, and I'll try to address them. I want to say first to Dr. Wolf, you mentioned that SEPs can be used to repair damage. I want to point out that if a violation causes damage, it's the duty of the violator to fix that outside of an SEP. We're going to require that they fix it. For instance, with the PXP spill, apart from any enforcement actions, they had to do the cleanup, they had to do every fix as well as they could any of the damage caused by the spill.
That was my Frenchism. Once in a while I'm saying something, but in English it doesn't quite come up correctly. So I do understand that.
Okay, I just want to make that point clear. As I say here, an SEP has to be a project that's above and beyond any other obligation that the discharger has. It can often be used to mitigate another problem in the same area, which is usually what happens. There's a lot of criteria that a discharger has to meet to get a SEP approved. I just mentioned a couple there. There has to be a nexus between the violation and the discharge, and that nexus can either be geographical or the nature of the violation.
Can you expand upon the nature of the violation? Like what the nexus is, considering the nature of?
Well, for instance, if the nature of the violation is a they had some erosion at a site and caused sediment to go into a creek, they have to fix that problem outside of any SEP. But if the board were to attach a penalty that to that violation, an appropriate nexus by violation type would or by the nature would be to do some restoration, perhaps in that watershed or a close by watershed, of similar types of problems that did not that were not caused by that same discharge.
And the farther away that the SEP was located, the weaker the nexus would be, even though it was the same nature, let's say erosion?
Not necessarily. The board could approve SEPs that are at the other end of the region but have the same general nature.
Like such as erosion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a similar concern to what Dr. Wolf raised regarding SEPs and the recommendation that we move away from approval of local SEPs on a routine basis in favor of directing all monies that would have been directed to SEPs to the Low Impact Development Institute and the CCAMP program. And I wonder about that in terms of this nexus.
That is a good question. The nature and geographic nexus with monitoring programs is pretty broad. The monitoring program can be used anywhere in the region and for just about any type of water quality parameter. So it's not that difficult to find that nexus there between any type of violation and the resulting water quality impact. So that one I'm not too concerned about. Low-impact development also deals with non-point source pollution on a pretty wide scale, and it's region-wide, so that can be used anywhere in the region, regardless of where the, I mean, even if the discharge occurred and a violation occurred in Santa Barbara County, Low-Impact Development Institute also does projects in Santa Barbara County.
So are we actually making a, I guess this is just a report for our information rather than a decision we would be making policy-wise as far as how, as far as approval of SEPs other than Low Impact Development Institute and Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program, how would those questions come to us as a board?
Right. That's a good point. And I also want to point out that SEPs are strictly voluntary. The board does not direct these SEPs. They have to come from the discharger. If the discharger would rather write a check to Sacramento, that's its prerogative, and that's perfectly acceptable. If the discharger wants to see some of that penalty used for a local project, it can propose a SEP. And then we can consider that SEP, and the board considers that SEP. But it's voluntary. And it will come to the board with each individual enforcement action.
Okay, so if a, I'm just trying to understand how the process works then. If there's a penalty and a discharger wants to put some of that penalty into a SEP rather than writing a check to Sacramento, they would take that to staff. Would staff then say, well, actually, what we'd like you to do is put money into CCAMP or Low Impact Development Institute? Or I'm just trying to figure out the what we see at the board, kind of how all that works.
Yeah, that's pretty much what staff would tell a discharger at this point. And as board members have pointed out, in the past, we have seen a lot of really good SEPs, and they've done a lot of really good projects in the region. But with our diminishing staff resources, you know, we have a responsibility when the board adopts a enforcement that includes a SEP, we have the responsibility to make sure that the money is spent as the board, as the discharger said it would do. We have to make sure that the project was completed effectively, and that requires staff oversight. And that's unfortunately what we're has been cut back. I had something else there. But
we were going to talk about the idea of funds out
right.
of the SEP
yeah.
covering staff time.
In fact, the SEP policy specifically states that if the project will require staff oversight, the discharger has to provide additional funds to cover staff oversight, which is actually a disincentive to do an SEP because they end up paying more than the penalty to do it.
Yeah. So my concern here is then the way it looks like to me, if there is a discharger who wants to do a SEP, they take it to staff. Staff says, well, really the only options that we're giving you for a SEP are Low Impact Development Institute and CCAMP. So it actually that issue never comes to the board. We're not making a decision here today on it. It's simply a report to us. But what's being reported to us is that there won't be any more that we shouldn't be typically approving these. Well, we won't have the option to approve them because it sounds like they won't come to us. Is that correct?
Staff recommendation would come to you as not to approve that, but the discharger will be here and is certainly able to make whatever comments they're interested in making, including discussion of a proposed SEP. So it's within the board's ability to consider other types of SEP.
If it gets to us.
Yeah.
If I could add. Go. Okay.
Yeah.
Or do you have a different topic within this discussion?
Well, Harvey's answered part of
it. Okay, go ahead, Dr. Hunter.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't. I wasn't looking to my left. I would just add that what I have seen occur with very good SEPs, especially major projects, is that the nonprofit community is also tracking on these violations and potential penalties, and they're very aware of those opportunities, and sometimes they often have good relationships with those entities. So I'm thinking of I believe that the Morro Bay National Estuary Program has received different kinds of funds mm-hmm. from penalty mm-hmm. sources, but one of them I believe was, like, for example, removing derelict vessels, which is a huge problem in Morro Bay. And they were able to go to, work proactively on their own behalf, and they negotiated an amount that contributed to removing a certain number of vessels. And so there are times when, from within the broader community itself, they're already linked in and have relationships. And so these things develop in different ways. So it's not always that the staff is going to say, well, here's LID or here's CCAMP. But there is a lot of awareness of CCAMP and the important information that's come out of that and what we've been able to do with that and the cooperative basis of that. But LID is newer and I think also merits the kind of support because LID is also working. They're the ones that are leading the joint effort, which is supporting all the smaller phase two communities that don't have the capacity to meet the conditions on their own. So again, LID is meeting a huge need that's very broad-based. So the benefit there, I think, is something we can consider to be very fairly and critically being, growing the kind of capacity that we need in very small communities.
Dr. Wolf has a question, but let me before I let you speak, Mr. Jeffries also wanted to finish.
Promoted?
No. You got promoted. Yeah.
Well, one of the questions I had for you, I wanted to explain, Harvey, that the SEP program is a voluntary program with to the violator, and there has been a number of violators have opted out not to go to the SEP program, and the board has tried to encourage them to go to the SEP because it's very beneficial for the area. And then there's been violators that have brought in projects which we have approved which have benefited the local communities to keep the dollars local. And I'm a strong supporter, and this board lobbied very heavily to the state board when the state board was considering taking big percentage of the SEP money. And I want you to address some of those items that the state board and their rationale that they were going to take the SEP money away from us or portions of that.
Right. I don't remember all the details, but when the state board was considering this SEP policy, the draft included provisions that I believe specified certain percentages of penalty amounts. If a penalty came from a region, then that money would be earmarked for projects in that region. And they didn't adopt that part of it, which we were very disappointed in. But I do want to point out that even if the board, if this board doesn't approve an SEP, the agency can still apply to the cleanup and abatement account and perhaps get approved to do a project. So, for instance, the National Estuary Program is still able to apply to the fund and see if they can get some money for some of those projects. The list of worthy SEPs is endless. There's just millions of them out there. And I also want to point out, too, which Dr. Hunter got to, is that staff resources is only part of our calculation here. What these two projects represent are the board's highest priority work, which we're trying to funnel these projects toward.
Dr. Wolf.
Yeah, you know, I know this item was published, and so it was subject to public comment, but I would suggest to my colleagues that a lot of the local environmental community would be very, very concerned of this direction, because you would hear from the Land Conservancy, you would hear from Central Coast Salmon Enhancement, you would hear from the NRCS, they all would be, and VRCDs, they would all be lining up here to make comments. I'm very concerned about this direction. And if the problem is staff resource and staff time, then perhaps we should rethink how as staff we manage the project and expect more of the burden of reporting and you know, clear, effective information being provided to staff. Since it appears that if we didn't have a staff issue, we wouldn't have this conversation. So if we do have a staff issue, perhaps let's address how the projects are being managed, and maybe, you know, you could have a stakeholder meeting with a different representative of environmental community to come up with a better way to help you minimize the amount of time you have to spend administrating these projects.
That is a good point. In fact, we have done some of that work already. We just recently completed an SEP with a local city, and they proposed a project. We required that they have a third party do the certification of the work. So we never visited the site. The local RCD, I believe, was the third party. They were there and gave us feedback that, yes, they did spend the money correctly and the project was completed. We still had to review the final reports. We still had to approve the project, review the project, and it took a significant amount of time.
Mr. Delgado.
Yeah, if I want to get clear, in the future, if a discharger comes to staff and has a SEP proposal, mm-hmm. will staff say, well, let's consider that proposal and bring it to the board? Or will staff say, well, we'd kind of like to discourage you from that idea, and we'd rather you look at these two ideas? Is that kind of direction?
We will do the latter.
Okay.
But as I said, the discharger, when it has its turn at the podium, can bring up whatever it
sure,
wants.
Sure, but I would think in the real world, a discharger who's already been through the process to get to be to have to do a SEP, they're probably going to think that staff is representing the whole system and the board. And they're probably not going to buck the system and saying, no, we're going to spend some money on developing a project proposal that's different than what staff wants, and we're going to take our chances at the board. I don't think that would happen.
That's a good point. And I haven't at all discussed settlements, which is a whole wrinkle to it. A lot of times we'll settle these violations with a settlement outside of a board hearing. The board has delegated to the executive officer authority to settle penalty amounts up to $300,000. So you'll rarely see an enforcement action come to the board for less than that amount, unless the discharger really feels that he's getting a bad deal. And if an SEP is part of that settlement, the discharger has to take into consideration, you know, do I want to go in front of the board and argue about an SEP when that'll open up the discussion on the violations too, and maybe I won't, maybe the board will increase the penalty amount. So there's a lot of factors that the discharger has to take into account.
You know, what I think, what I'm hearing is that it would be a good idea if staff did not present the SEP concept as these are your two options, and we're not going to consider anything you might come up with on your own. You know, it shouldn't be they should be directed to those two without any other options. People should be encouraged, if they want to come up with something else, that staff would consider that and that they would have some recourse with the board, separate from, you know, the other part of the violations. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've decided on everything except what the SEP should look like, and staff has a recommendation, and the discharger would rather see something else happen, I think that the discharger should be able to come to the board and plead its case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, that is the case, that can happen. The last negotiation that I was involved in, because I was disqualified from advising the board, you know, normally the executive officer is the advisor to the board, but, you know, I was disqualified, and so I was actually called in to help negotiate, and the discharger presented an initial proposal, which I thought was very off base and sounded like something that the company might do anyway, but propose it as a supplemental environmental project, sort of a do-good project. And I said that they could propose that. However, I mentioned our priorities and what I thought is something that I could stand behind and recommend in terms of a settlement. The discharger chose to go that route. This was something that did come to the board because it was way over the $300,000. Limit, so it was a recommendation for settlement to the board. I don't think the discharger brought forward their initial proposal, as I recall, but my point is that is the way it was posed to the dischargers, that they, first of all, they didn't have to propose any supplemental environmental project. They chose to. I gave them my opinion on it and thought that these would be something along these lines would be much better and something that we could recommend. And the discharger listened and seemed to understand very well why that was the case and chose to change their project. But the other thing, if I could mention about staff, there's been some discussion about including the cost for staff, or staff costs in the penalty calculation. And I don't want you to be misled into thinking that increases our staffing ability. It doesn't, because we can't hire any more people and haven't been able to for about 3 or 4 years. Actually, just last week, we got a further cut in our budget. So we still have to go further than before in terms of attrition to get out of the hole. So we're looking at a cut last week, which further reduces the amount of staff time we have. So putting staff costs into the calculation doesn't provide us any more staff time. And yes, a lot of projects are potentially great, but we were kind of getting killed by the oversight that was required for many, many, many projects. As Vice Chair Jeffries was pointing out, our board has historically been a big proponent of supplemental environmental projects. And consequently, I think we ended up with probably more of them than a lot of other regions. Some regions don't want to use them at all. So we took a strategic move internally a couple of years ago to move in this direction of trying to steer towards projects that are basically already in place, where the oversight is already provided, and it's simply adding to the ability of these endowments to be able to do the work that the board has already identified as high priority. We're actually going to be proposing adding to the scope when you're talking about nexus and questions about nexus, we're proposing to add to the scope here with an item coming up, an item number 12, which is the groundwater assessment and protection program, part of the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. So Harvey is predicting the future here to say groundwater and surface water. So that would be an additional groundwater component, which really broadens the potential nexus for the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program and the good that it will provide. The leverage that we get out of this is huge, because if you think back to the 2004 agricultural order and now this most recent one or 2 months ago, we know that the footprint of agriculture in water quality and public health in our region is huge. There's no comparison to it. I'm certain that we would not have been able to adopt the orders that we adopted sequentially in 04 initially, and again 2 months ago, if we did not have the information from Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. So it's not just monitoring for data's sake. This is what informs us of what we need to do to be effective in water quality control. So it's gigantic in our region in terms of its leverage and its effectiveness. So I think we should think in those terms as well. And yes, there are a lot of great projects. There is still the capability of dischargers to bring those to you. Maybe we should be more clear in their option of being able to do that, but I think we should also be clear in what we as staff think is appropriate in terms of priorities. The further staff is cut back, the more it's incumbent on us to set hard priorities, stick to them as much as we can, and be realistic in terms of staffing, at the same time zeroing in on what are the highest priority problems in the region.
Dr. Wolf.
I would suggest, Mr. Brick, that, you know, I would suggest, Mr. Brick, that the last comments you made were more applicable to the following item. So I would like to go back to the task at hand, specifically local benefit of SEP. And I feel very strongly about that. And I think our responsibility is both on a micro level and macro level. And what you're suggesting is we take a macro level approach. There is a duality in our responsibility. We have a local responsibility, meaning within specific streams in other aquatic habitats, and then we have on a bigger base responsibility over, you know, basin-wide and the whole Central Coast. So I really don't want us to put all our eggs in one basket, so to speak, of looking at, well, let's put all the money in this other program and, you know, somebody else will take care of it. I like your comment about utilizing third party. I think there are ways to improve the process of a SEP. So before we take SEP and say, okay, that's not a very effective way of using our staff resource, let's see if we can do a little better job in the reporting from these different agencies. And I can assure you, being myself involved with several of these agencies personally, if a choice for these agencies, environmental groups, is either we'll never be able to utilize SEP again or we got to do a better job reporting, and you know, they will take the latter. So I don't want to, you know, take everybody's time, but I apologize for being a little bit passionate about this particular topic, but I think it's very important.
Before Mr. Delgado speaks, haven't we had situations where the money that could be allocated to a SEP was relatively small and that there would be very little benefit for the expenditure of those funds, and therefore it would be more worthwhile to pool that money into these bigger projects? Has that been a discussion we've had?
I don't know specifically. We've had projects that are fairly small, $20,000-$30,000, and some that are way, way bigger.
Okay, Mr. Delgado.
Yeah, even $20,000 or $30,000. It seems like if a discharger had a network with local nonprofits that on that scale they could do something, you know, relevant or meaningful on that scale. I'm really glad for this discussion. I think that's why it was put on the agenda, so we could learn more about SEPs and how violations are processed. But I would suggest that we have a more comprehensive discussion on a future agenda where we discuss the pros and cons of local SEPs, and we discuss the options that might be available to control staff costs, such as requiring contractors or third parties do some of the oversight that staff typically does, and that we discuss the pros and cons of our board having a policy of prioritizing monitoring to receive violation monies, because maybe we think that overall we should focus on a priority rather than having a lot of separate smaller projects that don't demonstrate a meaningful chunk of progress in any direction. And I think one of the pros of local SEPs is that it's a means by which our agency can better engage public participation, public knowledge of what we do, et cetera. So I think it's a bigger subject than we have time or preparation for today.
Well, we could bring it back for board discussion. What would be appropriate?
To do just that.
Just to do that.
Are you wondering about timing?
Yeah. Sometime this year?
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure the next meeting is the
right
best bet because of timing.
But I think the main thing, Mr. Chair, is that we keep the money local, the work in the local community, and I think this is why the position this board over the years has taken its position to support SEP programs, even with the state board, is that we keep the money here locally and working locally. I don't care if it's $10,000 or $20,000. Even $10,000, you can fix a culvert, and it could make a lot of difference in a particular creek or waterway. So once it goes to the state, yeah, you can apply for it, but whether you get it or not, that's something else. So if we can decide, and I, as a board member, I think that's part of my job is to make those decisions. The staff can present and make the recommendations, but it's our job to make the final decision and give the direction to the staff.
Okay.
A couple of non-SEP questions, if we're ready to move on to the rest of your material.
Sure.
You started your presentation by talking about the process by which you put a price tag on a violations penalty, and I'm wondering if you have found in your experience that by going through this fair and consistent across the board process that the penalties do have a deterrent effect.
I would say that yes, they do. I went to a conference a couple weeks ago and they actually had some evidence to back that up. It was really interesting, though, because the analysis they did was that, especially for for-profit businesses, you know, they're out there to make money, and sometimes it's a calculated risk that they'll take to violate. And so to really be deterrent, the penalty has to not only recover that economic benefit, but it has to take into account the chance of being detected. So the formula that these researchers came up with is if there's a 10% chance of being detected, your penalty better be at least 10 times the amount of the economic benefit.
And is it?
I would shoot for that.
But, I mean, this process, does it?
It can. Oh, yeah, it'll take that into account.
Okay. You know, it produces penalties that are 10 times.
It can.
And more.
Yeah.
And more.
Okay. And my other question was that we have 39 pages of a table that probably has, I don't know, 100 different violations. And it seems to me that somewhere between 40 to 70% of these, probably closer to the 70%, are in San Luis Obispo County. And San Luis Obispo County is not as large as some of the other counties in our region. And so my question is that just proximity to...
Some of it may be. I haven't done that type of analysis, but most of these violations are self-reported. So we rely on the dischargers to report their own violations. A lot of them are not self-reported, or they're spills that are detected by other agencies. But I'm not sure why that bias is in there. That is kind of curious. I haven't looked at it from that perspective. But I can say that with the staff living in this area, we are going to see more things in San Francisco County.
It may be the dischargers in our area, when they do something wrong, they know who to go to, so they're in a hurry to let you know that they've violated
hopefully
their permits.
Okay. Mr. Mayor, I'll tell you, it always hasn't been. Monterey County has had its share in the past, so I don't think the staff or even the dischargers are zeroing in on one particular county. And if you look at, you got the correctional facilities. That's always been one of my bugs over the years. It's constantly in violation, and number of reports. And we've had state officials here to tell us that they're going to take care of it and repair it, but it still goes on and on and on. And if you look at, you take some of those out, and then it narrows it down considerably.
If you look at it month to month, get a perspective, you'll see it bounces around.
Yep.
But the majority of them are self-reported. These are people that they're required to tell us when they violate their permit. So,
thank you.
Okay. Any other board comments or questions? Is there anything else with your report? I have one speaker card.
Okay.
Mr. Wallace? Okay. If you want to address the board, we need speaker cards up here in advance. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Wallace. I'm the district administrator for the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District. And following the conversation of the board here, we agree with a number of the comments. We came here today to ask that you not limit the number or the type of SEPs because of the local benefit of keeping the dollars here to repair and to enhance the things that are in this area where violations may have occurred. So I think that's our main point, and we agree with the comments of the board. Unfortunately, we had a spill in December 2010. We're under discussions right now with your state board about the violation, and we expect to be back here with some discussions about SEPs. So I think we hate to be the guinea pig, but I think that we'll have an opportunity to discuss some of the local benefits to which we could put those monies to use. In reference to staff cost, we appreciate the problem that all agencies have with reduction in staff. And in terms of the SEPs and using those funds to outsource some of those oversight functions, I think would be appropriate, and to compensate the regional board for their staff time as well. I know that in talking with Roger, hearing Roger's comments, that it's not easy to do that sometimes, but I think some of the examples that were talked about where you did have some oversight from third-party environmental organizations were successful and could augment your staff responsibilities. I think then that to go to perhaps another meeting or discussion about this, along with some stakeholders, that will have an opportunity to present some SEP projects to you, and some of the environmental groups would be an appropriate forum to discuss this more fully, and hopefully not just limit the flexibility of the program to two main programs. And then finally, in terms of just the overall discussions about enforcement, I think it's important to know that all the agencies out there that I'm associated with are trying to do a good job. And the fines and so forth that are imposed really are a burden to those agencies to do the projects that meet the existing requirements, and more importantly, to be able to meet future requirements. So I think there's a balance and equity that the board needs to be aware of when they impose those fines. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you for your comments. Okay. No more board questions, no more speaker cards. So we'll bring this back sometime this year, and perhaps, Mr. Packard, in the interim, before the board has a chance to discuss our SEP policy publicly, what I have heard from the board, and I think you have too, is that we wouldn't want any dischargers to think that they don't have the option of creating and recommending their own SEP. And if they want to come to the board with something, that, you know, they could do so without any recourse. So if they want to take the time to do it, and that wouldn't affect any other thing that you've settled out with them, that we would, you know, entertain that. You know, I mean, if you get to the SEP is the one component of this, and you've got your recommendations, and they may have something that they feel strongly about, let them come to the board with it without recourse to them being in jeopardy of having something else jacked up on the other side.
And
is that what I'm hearing from?
If I may, Chair.
Yes.
I think that's good for now. And then if we were to have a workshop as just suggested.
Well, it's coming back to us as an agenda item so we can openly discuss our SEP policy.
Right. So that the point of that workshop or whatever meeting we call it would be for us to decide on a policy. And that policy might be we don't really want to do SEPs other than these two. Or the policy might be we want to be similar to status quo historical, where all SEPs are just equally at the onset have merits.
Yeah, all options will be on the
right.
table.
So would that be the purpose of the next
yes.
time we discuss this, is to decide whether we wanted to change our policy or not?
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Hunter.
Yeah, to that point, I would suggest to staff that that would be a good opportunity also to bring a little more detail on the status of the joint effort and just how the program has been expanded, and so that we are clear also on, as Dr. Wolf pointed out, there is a micro, very, very micro component to LID that could come out of those efforts and the leadership and guidance and technical support. So it would be really important to help us see the nexus there when it may seem like we're directing dollars to a large pool, but in actuality, it's money on the ground for the kind of changes that we want to see in terms of EMPs in municipal settings. So that, as well as, I guess, item 12, we're going to see more about, hear more about the new groundwater monitoring component of CCAMP. So it should be, you know, that we see a balanced kind of presentation from staff so that we understand how our priorities are changing, how we can better meet those priorities.
Ms. McCann.
Lisa McCann, Section Manager for the Water Protection and Planning Section. I just wanted to clarify, I think I heard you say joint effort. Do you mean the Low Impact Development Initiative? Okay, it's an important distinction for us.
I'm sorry, and why don't you tell me what that distinction is for you? Because I think of it as the joint effort, so.
That's what we use, and we've spoken to you about, as shorthand for our joint effort to develop hydro modification control requirements.
Right.
And the Low Impact Development Initiative is involved in that, but the responsibilities and implementation of the Low Impact Development Initiative in our region is much broader.
Yes. Okay, thank you for clarifying. It's, I am thinking of it as one large
okay.
set of related actions.
All right. We've had enough discussion on this item. It'll come back to us. I think we should take a break, right, before we launch into, yeah. It'll be agenda item 13?
Correct.
And then 12 following that. So about a 10-minute break. We're going to